Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Up until very recent history, if you were a person who believed in the supernatural, which was basically everyone, and lived in a historically Christian land, and you were in some sort of predicament, you would probably pray to a patron saint. Are you a sailor who worries about choppy waters? Well, you pray to St. Nicholas. And you could also pray to him if you're a maiden. Having a problem with your taxes? You pray to St. Matthew. What about having a good sense of humor? You pray to St. Lawrence. Patron saints come out of Catholic theology, the idea that there was a particular saint who could be a focal point to prayer, and then he would take that prayer and then intercede to God on your behalf for a particular matter. It's a belief that's been around for centuries and continues to exist within Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy. And it's had tremendous impact on how people negotiated their problems. In this episode, a guest is returning for the third time, Michael Foley. Michael's been a lot of fun to have on the show. He is a professor at Baylor. We talk about medieval clergy, and we also talk about drinking at the same time. He writes about topics, and he does biographical profiles, and he pairs them with cocktails. So his new book is called Drinking with Your Patron Saints. In this episode, since it's St. Patrick's Day, we're going to open with looking at St. Patrick, which information about him is historical, which is apocryphal, like chasing all the snakes out of Ireland, which would be impossible for one person to do. And he also made a drink and a cocktail to go along with his life. So if you want to learn about mixology, this is a really good episode. If you want to look at the worldview and the beliefs that people had throughout the Middle Ages and the modern period, that's also a part of this episode, and also some fascinating biographical profiles, like St. Catherine of Alexandria, who was executed by a spiked wheel, St. Nicholas, the future Santa Claus, who helped maidens get married and avoid prostitution, so that's why he's the patron saint of maidens, St. Jude, the patron saint of desperate cases, St. Philip Neri, who's remembered as pulling practical jokes and is a patron saint for guys who tell corny dad jokes like myself. So it's a really fun episode, so I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Michael Foley. Michael, welcome back to the show, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
All right. A little bit early, but you know, when this is released, it'll come out about that time. All right. Well, we have a lot to talk about, but figure it's fair to start off with Patrick. So in the past, when we've done episodes, and this is number three, we've looked at the medieval clergy and also drinking, which can go hand in hand pretty well. So let's do the same as we look at Patrick. What is he the patron saint of? How much of our understanding of him that he brought Christianity to Ireland, but he also chased the snakes out is historical and ahistorical? And most importantly, I figure we could start with this. What is your cocktail that you made about him?
Well, we can start with a cocktail. That's pretty easy. It's called an Irish ale cocktail. It basically is the same as a Moscow mule, but with Irish whiskey instead. And I didn't invent it, but I discovered it and I'm very pleased with it. It's a very refreshing kind of cocktail to have for the spring.
Yeah, that's nice, too. I enjoyed Moscow mules for the winter. So in the cold, crisp springs of Ireland, when it's still rain at about 34 degrees, I think that could do the job well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so let's talk about Patrick. I mean, that you know him historically. First of all, what do we know about him? And then the things that are ahistorical, like chasing all the snakes out of Ireland. If you think about that for about 5 seconds, you realize that's impossible. I mean, if one man can do that in circa the 5th century, more power to him for a area the size of Ireland. But I can't get rid of pests in my meager estate that is not as big as Ireland. So what do we know about Patrick, and how do these apocryphal legends about him come around?
Well, I do like the legend about the snakes. I don't know exactly when it first arose, but the symbolism is pretty clear. He banished evil from Ireland, particularly the evil of the Druids. The snakes were never on the island of Ireland. They never found their way there, so there were no snakes for him to drive out. But there were spiritual snakes, and the Druids were a formidable enemy. They practiced a very dark religion, and they were not happy at all to see Christianity spread on the island. So it made sense that this was sort of symbolized by the expulsion of the snakes.
And what is Patrick's story? From what I understand, he was taken into slavery into Ireland, returns to England, comes back. But can you give a bio of him?
That's pretty much it. We have an autobiography by St. Patrick. Scholars pretty much agree it is an authentic autobiography. Now, of course, you still have to rely on his word for it. He does say that he was kidnapped by pirates, that he was from Roman Britain. That could mean England. It could also mean Scotland. And he was abducted at the age of 16, made to be a shepherd slave in Ireland for 6 years until his angel told him to find a ship that was 200 miles away, which he took and was reunited with his family, but eventually felt the call to the priesthood. And from what we can tell, he actually traveled the entire continent of Europe from one end of France to the other. And there he was ordained. He studied with people like St. Martin of Tours, kind of the who's who of Christian Europe at the time, and was eventually given the commission to evangelize Ireland from the Pope.
Huh, okay. And from what we know, how much of a headway did he make? Did he really make a big difference in the fate of the island, or did he more establish a beachhead that other people later would follow up on and build out the church infrastructure?
I think he really made a difference. He turned the island around. I don't know what the percentage was of Druids versus Catholics by the time he died. I'm sure it was not 100% Catholics, but I think it was more than just a beachhead. I think he was pretty successful.
Okay, and I was going to ask what he's a patron saint of, and you can get to that, but I think this is a good thing to stop on because your new book focuses on patron saints and also drinking as well. Nice combination. And you'll have a lot of stories, which we'll get to. But for those who don't know the background, patron saints can seem weird, where if somebody is forgetting something, they pray to a patron saint, or they're going to go on a journey, they pray to a patron saint, or if they're going to do their taxes, or if they're going to tell a joke. This is something I don't know much about, and we were talking about this before we started the interview. An area of Catholic belief that has a huge impact on history that I do know about are indulgences. That plays into pilgrimages and crusades, and it's something that it could be used, it could be abused, and Catholics would point to its origins in the Bible, but it exists in a nascent form in the early centuries of the church, but then takes on more definite form in the Middle Ages. So how does the understanding of patron saints come around? What is its origin, and does it crystallize in later centuries?
It is more of a development. One of the things that surprised me is I sort of believed the line that I'd once been told that, in a sense, patron saints were a sort of replacement of the patron gods, that just as you went to a particular god or goddess for a particular cause, you would do the same thing with the saints. So patron saints in that way would be sort of like, a sort of watered down monotheism for recovering polytheists. But what I discovered was that's not where it comes from. It comes from Roman society, and it comes from the patron-client relationship, which was a very important glue for Roman society, that the patron was the guy in town who got things done. And so if you're having trouble with the government or having trouble with your neighbor, you went to this patron who knew how to get happy results. You can think of it as sort of a legal and moral version of the Godfather. So, I'm sorry, go ahead. So, so when the Roman Empire was kind of falling apart, bishops became a lot more important as patrons of their people. They would intervene with the imperial government when it overtaxed you. They would intervene when there was a corrupt official who was incarcerating or executing people. And for example, Saint Nicholas, who's such a popular saint, later becomes Santa Claus. Before he became a patron saint in death, he was already a patron in life. He already acted as the patronus for his people. So it was sort of a natural migration to go from life to death.
Patronus, for most listeners, though they don't know the background, they'll immediately think of Harry Potter, which does use phrases in Latin, so there's at least something there to go on for learning. And it's interesting you mention that, because the folk belief around patron saints is very strong. In fact, in Istanbul, where I used to live, there are some historical church groups there, both Orthodox and Catholic, and there was an Armenian Catholic church that had a little bit of a reputation because for women suffering from infertility, they would go there and they would pray. And you probably know this better than I do, if there's a patron saint for this. Whatever it is, there was an icon there that they would pray to. So even amongst people of different religions, there's folk belief, which gets me to a question about patron saints that I think for reformers, they would point to this and indulgences as something that's this paganistic barnacle that's left on the Catholic Church. And the point of the Reformation is to scrape off these barnacles so the ship of Christendom can sail straight and true. And then Catholic apologists would argue, all right, there are people who are abusing these things like indulgences and patron saints, but they're more renegades who are using the language of the church to make a buck. But if you actually look at the core theology of the church, it's much more sound. So as the idea of patron saints develops, let's go to the Middle Ages. How is it used and abused from what you know?
Definitely not used and abused in the way that indulgences were. I think they were far more prone to abuse. I can't really think of ways in which patron saints were abused, aside from perhaps exaggerated promises of speedy delivery if you did a certain thing for them. So, for example, one of the reasons why St. Christopher is such a popular patron saint of travelers is that there, and why we have the St. Christopher medal, is that there was this medieval belief that if you looked on the image of St. Christopher, you would not die that day. And it's because of that that we have St. Christopher on our dashboards, St. Christopher medals. And in England, the second most popular image that was made during the Middle Ages was that of St. Christopher, second only to the Blessed Virgin Mary among the saints. And people would often put images of St. Christopher, especially the wealthy, they would have them carved on the outside of their home so that passers-by would see the image. It was sort of a public service that others would see the image of St. Nicholas and it would protect them for the day. So that obviously is a superstition. The kernel of truth in it is that it is good to pray to patron saints. They are not a substitute for God. They're not an alternative to God. They are the friends of God. And just as you ask your friends in the pew to pray for you for a particular intention, you can do the same with your friends in heaven.
Well, let's go to Patrick. What is he the patron saint of?
Well, obviously of Ireland. He is also the patron saint of snakes, and the patron saint for the fear of snakes. So whether you are pro-snake or anti-snake, Patrick is your man.
So I'm wondering how this plays out. Do you know of any people, I don't know the name of a scientist that studies reptiles, that or exterminators, have you seen it one way or another, people who are pro or anti-snake appropriating him his image?
That is a good question. I do not know the answer to that.
Well, let's look at some people who, when you hear it, you think, wait, what is that? But then I love to hear the context and the explanation for things that on their face don't make any sense. So the patron saint of comedians or someone for telling a joke, Saint Lawrence, how did this come about?
Oh, yes. So Catholic hagiography has a very dark and black sense of humor. And perhaps we get this from Saint Lawrence himself, who was a deacon who was roasted alive on a gridiron by the Romans. And he took it with such courage and magnanimity that he was able to crack a couple of jokes while he was being slowly cooked. And one of them was, "You can turn me over, I'm done on this side." And because of that, he has become the patron saint of comedians and cooks.
For all fathers out there, you have, if you want to write out a dad joke and you want it to land, then he's your man. And then also your drink. I have to ask this too. How does he connect to it?
Well, he's got a couple, but there are a couple of, for example, St. Lawrence cocktails. They're Canadian in origin because it was named after the Bay of St. Lawrence? I can't remember its exact name now. So that's one option for St. Lawrence.
All right. And then someone who, for a better sense of humor, there was another saint too, which I think this connects pretty close to where I am in Kansas City, if I have the right drink. But it's St. Philip Neri. Where was he based?
In Italy. He was spent most of his adult career, or I should say apostolate, in Rome. And he was an absolutely marvelous saint. He was extremely zany. He played tons of practical jokes, mostly on himself, and would also have some of his disciples do sort of zany things. He was all about mortifying your vanity, and he did this through humor.
Okay. Do you know any of the pranks or stuff that he did that stick out?
He would sometimes shave half his beard off and walk through the public streets. He would wear extremely dorky, mismatched clothes. He had to teach his disciples humility. He had one of them carry a giant dog through the streets of Rome. Rather than walk the dog, he had to just like carry the dog. Things like that, just totally bizarre things.
And your drink, the Boulevardier.
Oh, yeah.
Does that by chance have a Boulevard included within it, Kansas City's own drink, or is that something else?
The Boulevardier is a different kind of drink. It's an old drink, and I assigned it to St. Philip Neri because he was the classical Boulevardier. A Boulevardier is someone who walks up and down the boulevard, and that's exactly what he did. He just walked up and down the streets of Rome and won people's hearts over to him. He was a great apostolate of the common man.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky?
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Another person, too, that you mentioned earlier, St. Nicholas. I know that he is the patron saint of maidens and sailors. And the reason I know that is because the book Miss Rumphius by Barbara Cooney is dedicated to him. That's a children's book that, to my kids, I've probably read about 2,000 or 3,000 times. Huh. So I might as well know this fact. How did he become the patron saint of these particular things? As you mentioned, he's the inspiration for Santa Claus. And what is your drink associated with him?
I've got a couple of drinks. On the Feast of St. Nicholas, there is a traditional drink called Bishop's Wine from the Netherlands. It's sort of a hot wine punch, and it's very good. My friend Peter Kwasniewski also has a delightful drink called the Incensed Bishop, which has to do with a legend about his behavior at the Council of Nicaea. He got so upset with the heretic Arius, according to this legend, that he slapped him. It's probably not true, but it's still a great story. But he is the patron saint of more causes than any other saint except the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Huh.
It's insane the number of patronages that he has. a lot of this because of Eastern Orthodox devotion. So some of these aren't necessarily practiced in the West, but they still are authentic patronages. Literally hundreds. They're not all listed in the book. They're just too many of them.
Do you know why that is? Why has he taken such a foothold? Is it because of his role in the early church and that has this multiplier effects? Or is there something about his story that connects with people that made him this omnipresent patron?
It's both. I think he was one of the very first prominent saints who was clearly a patron saint of the little guy. When you think of the saints of the early church, the first thing we see are the martyrs. And they give this incredible testimony and witness to Christ. But you don't think of them sort of as supporters of the little guy. You think of them primarily as people whose blood was shed for our Lord. So the martyrs are in this kind of special category. And then following the martyrs are what we call the confessors, holy men and women who did not die a martyr's death, but we recognize as saints. And most of the first confessors were these great minds, great theologians, the fathers of the church, Augustine, St. John Chrysostom, Pope Gregory the Great, and so on. These are mighty men, and they certainly were great pastors of souls, but they were also these sort of brilliant intellectuals. Nicholas was the first saintly bishop, it seems to me, who wasn't necessarily a great intellectual. He was just kind of, in a sense, you could think of him as just sort of a blue-collar kind of bishop. He wasn't blue-collar himself. He came from a wealthy family. But he very much was just a sort of supporter of the common man. I think that really connected with people, and they sort of multiplied patronages as a result of that.
If I remember our last discussion, there was his skull that's a holy relic that was examined, and I think they saw he had a broken nose.
Exactly. So that's one of the things that gives credence to the legend that he slapped Arius at the Council of Nicaea, like, oh, well, he was a pugilist. He was used to settling things this way. The problem, though, is that the broken nose could have come from torture. He had been imprisoned during the Roman persecutions. He lived to see those days end, but it was very easy to imagine his nose getting broken in prison. Or it could have actually been broken posthumously when these Italian merchants absconded the relics of St. Nicholas from his original place in Turkey and brought them to Bari, Italy. They did a very hasty job of it because they were basically raiding the tomb. They were stealing the relics. And so they broke a lot of bones in the process. So they could have broken his nose.
If it is true that he did get it broken fighting Arius, and he is a patron saint of the common man, I'd like to think he's similar to Nacho Libre, the monk who fought as a luchador to save an orphanage. I might be off there, but I like to imagine that.
I could see that work.
Well, I want to take a little segue before I come back to some of these saints, but I'm guessing that the sources of a lot of these stories come from hagiographies, which are legends of saints. And I've seen hagiographies in a couple of places. One of my professors who looked at the Ottoman Empire in the 1500s and 1700s was looking at hagiographies of Eastern Orthodox clergymen, most of whom were martyred for, in this case, now converting to Islam, but it could have been other things. And she used it as a historical source. And as a historian, she would discount supernatural elements, but think, the reason that he was being martyred, the things that he was doing that seemed to have resonance with the community, whether it's protecting women from being married to the Turks or stopping exploitation of authorities, can tell us about what was important at that time. Maybe authorities were corrupt and it took a holy man to lay down his life. Maybe there was worry in the community of Christian women marrying Muslim men, so he was laying down his life for that as well. Can you just describe hagiographies a little bit? Because my audience is very interested in these types of sources and how our historical understanding comes down. First is a religious source, but then also how historians use hagiographies to understand the past.
Yeah, it is a complicated issue, but what you are saying reminds me of a saying before Vatican II, when during the office of Matins, during the second nocturne, the life of a saint would be read. And there was an old French saying about somebody who engaged in pious dissimulation. He lies like a second nocturne. And that was a reference to the kind of exaggerated stories that often have to do with the lives of the saints. And you're right, your teacher is right. You can always sort of gleam, okay, there are kernels of truth in this exaggerated tale. The exaggerated tale is often the result of kind of a game of telephone. As it gets passed from one generation to the next, it gets embellished. The problem, though, of taking too historical approach with these stories is that you basically try to unscramble an omelet. And it's really hard to separate the fact from the fiction. Mm-hmm. So I agree, we have to recognize these legends are legends. On the other hand, I don't think we'll ever be able to separate the wheat from the chaff. And so my attitude is simply not accept the legend as absolutely true, but cherish the legend. These are family stories that have been passed down in our somewhat quirky, dorky, and not always literate family. But you cherish them nonetheless. And you're not sure what part is true and what part isn't. But you recognize that there is value to the tale. And so you keep it and you pass it on.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing, too. There's an ecumenical aspect of saints' legends where in every branch of Christendom, you can find them. There's Catholic ones we've mentioned. There's Orthodox ones in the ancient world and also the Ottoman world and the modern era. Protestants, things like Fox's Book of Martyrs. You'll see these sprinkled around different areas.
Yeah, talk about legends.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's all over the place.
A lot of exaggerations in that one.
Actually, you know, I've never heard a historical take on Fox's Book of Martyrs. Just as a very quick seg for readers, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, of course. So that was written prior or during the Reformation. No, it was after the Reformation in England of Catholics who had persecuted Protestants within England. And Fox's book was a collection of this. So let me know if I'm missing anything. And then also, historically, what are issues with that work? I'm curious.
Well, you're right about the profile, and I don't know a great deal about it, except that it's figures about the number of Protestants killed under the reign of Queen Mary was outrageously exaggerated. The whole thing is made to vilify Catholics. And you know, obviously, there are some valid criticisms to be made of the way Queen Mary tried to reinstitute Catholicism after the death of her father, Henry VIII. But, you know, it's Fox's stuff is just, it's propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the age of tracts, I think this was when people would print pamphlets and stuff like that. It's an early kind of flame war era where if you want to rile people up, great time to do that.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Oh, well, let's return to some of your other profiles. When you mentioned St. Jude, you link him specifically to finding a parking spot when you're running late. So what's his story? Why is he a patron saint of this? And then what's a drink associated with him?
Well, I associate him with, this is my own suggestion. He's not been officially given this designation, but I think he's a great saint to pray to when you are really, really in need of finding a parking space and you're running late, because he's the patron saint of desperate causes. And when I feel very desperate is when I'm looking for a parking spot.
Right. And how's the desperado made?
Yes, so there are a couple of drinks in his honor, and one of them is the Desperado, and it is indeed an interesting drink. There are actually two of them. The one I'm thinking of, though, is made with Chinar, which is, I believe, an Italian artichoke liqueur, and it is crazy bitter. The recipe only calls for a quarter of an ounce of Chinar, but it's still kind of a punch in the face when you have this cocktail. Maybe I'm not selling it very well right now, but it actually is really good. The first sip just hits you hard, but then by the time you get to the bottom of the glass, you sort of sense the complexity of the drink. It's got a very interesting sort of flavor profile. So I do recommend it. It is an interesting drink.
There's another person too, Catherine of Alexandria, and I get my Catherines mixed up. I know Catherine of Siena, she's in the 1300s. That's not the case for Catherine of Alexandria. So when did she live? What's her story? And how does she connect to headaches?
She is supposed to be an early church martyr. I say supposed to be because she's one of those saints that historians will say, well, we don't really have proof that she ever actually existed. The earliest biographies of her are from the 7th century. We don't have any testimony from the 4th century or 3rd century. But there is a really strong tradition of praying to St. Catherine of Alexandria in both the East and the West. And St. Joan of Arc says she saw her. When St. Joan of Arc had her visions, she saw Michael the Archangel, Catherine of Alexandria, Margaret of Antioch, and she swore upon the threat of her life that these are the saints that she saw. So this is, again, one of those things where you're forced to choose between what the historical experts say and what other saints are saying. But the reason why she's the patron saint of headaches is that she was beheaded.
That will solve it real quickly.
Yeah.
What's the drink associated with that?
Let's see. I think I have a lot of recommendations for Catherine of Alexandria. You'll have to forgive me, Scott. In the course of researching this book, some brain cells were destroyed in the process.
You have trillions of backups, so it's fine.
Oh, good. I don't remember what I assigned Catherine.
That's fine. Hey, it's all the more reason for people to check it out. So
absolutely. I'll beguile them.
And then there are others that you associate with things that are not part of the medieval tradition of patron saints, such as saints for credit cards and parking spaces. And or we already discussed parking spaces, but credit cards and Uber drivers and social media. So who are some of those people and how did you associate them with these different things?
I'm very excited and proud of myself for figuring out who the patron saint of credit cards should be. It is Saint Expeditus because, and I'm not making this up, he is the patron saint of both financial problems and procrastination.
So that would be for tax season and TurboTax users right there?
There you go, exactly. Now, there is actually an official patron saint of taxes, and that's Saint Matthew, who was a tax collector. But yeah, Expeditus works too.
Yeah, I could see that a lot because in the context that people would imagine Matthew, if you had a sizable debt and weren't able to pay on time, then you'd be thrown in debtor's prison.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I could see him getting all sorts of prayers for that.
Absolutely.
What about social media?
I also assign St. Expeditus because he's the patron saint of procrastination.
Okay, which would definitely lead to that.
Exactly.
This just kind of came to my mind, but when you were talking about Catherine and how she's separated a few hundred years from the earliest accounts about her, I could see where that's a criticism, but I think it also comes back to the point you were making earlier that if you can apply these critical methods, but the problem is if you get far enough back in the past, especially in the ancient world, this applies to almost everyone except for isolated cases like Julius Caesar, who wrote an autobiography or who wrote an account of his military, and then we can read that directly. King Arthur, I think there's full accounts don't really come till about 500 or 600 years after his death. And the connection between those writings and a historical person that could be him are very, very, very weak. So like you said, not to say that every single person has to exist in the way that they're described in every account, but this is just a general problem with the ancient world of finding sources that are very close to the person, if that matches closely with your experience of understanding these people historically.
No, that's absolutely true. And then even when you do have autobiographical information, you don't know for 100% how accurate their own information is. Maybe they misremembered certain details, or maybe they're even writing in a certain kind of code. That one of the things that makes hagiography difficult to interpret is that it's written in a particular genre. So there are certain details that may have had a certain meaning to their audience, which doesn't have meaning for us now. And so they're speaking kind of between the lines about something through these details, but we don't know what they are. Hmm. And then we can sort of misinterpret these later. So, yeah, it gets really complicated.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word UNPLUG to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word UNPLUG to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word UNPLUG to 30605 and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text UNPLUG to 30605. Can you think of examples of where you were reading the writing and when you first encountered it, you thought, what on earth does this mean? And then maybe you saw a commentary and they explained it that, oh, okay, I see how that could make sense to someone at some time.
Yeah, I can't think of a perfect example of what I'm thinking, but I do know that, for example, the accounts of the early virgin martyrs, like St. Catherine of Alexandria, follow a very interesting pattern. According to the pattern, the Romans come up with some kind of ingenious torture to threaten the maiden or kill her, and it fails. And eventually, the only way that they can execute the maiden is by beheading. And I think this was code for God's in charge. The Romans may think they're in charge, but I will choose the time and manner in which I allow my martyrs to be martyred. So even if it doesn't look like God's in charge because his saints are being murdered, God is in charge. And the Romans are the fools, and those who believe in the saints are wise.
And that's an interesting thing because a long time ago, I did an episode on ancient jokes in the Roman and Greek worlds. And some of them are still funny today. There's one that's exactly like the Monty Python dead parrot sketch where you sold a slave to me who died. Well, he wasn't like that when you bought him. But then there's other jokes that I can't possibly understand how it's funny. Which, like you said, when there's a moral message, that's also a way to kind of sniff out if something is fake, like a Gnostic gospel, where it talks about luxury items that we should abstain from, like sugar, which wasn't part of the European or the Mediterranean world until probably the 600 or 700s. So that wouldn't be something at the time. Coming back to these different patron saints, are there any that stick out to you as your favorite?
I have to confess, I've taken a shine to St. Nicholas after learning more about him. I'm also a big fan of St. Joseph, who is also growing in the number of patronages. Joseph was kind of a late starter. He got a bad rap, according to some apocryphal stories about him that were in the Christian drinking water for a long time. So devotion to him has been a relatively late development. It really started to take off in the 19th century, and now we're seeing sort of more devotions to him. But I think Joseph is in many respects a hidden gem that is only now beginning to be appreciated.
Is the Joseph the husband of Mary we're talking about, or a different one?
No, it is the husband of Mary, okay. Yes.
So why do you think it started the 19th century and it only took off at this much later date compared to other patron saints?
I think it depended on a development of devotion to the Holy Family, which didn't start until really the 15th century. And then once you realize, hey, he's part of the Holy Family, there was a growing appreciation for his marriage to the Blessed Virgin Mary, his protection of Jesus. He was, like I say, saddled by an apocryphal gospel that portrayed him as an old man who was on his second marriage, who was riddled with doubt. But it turns out that none of those things are true. He probably wasn't that old. He's probably in his 30s when he married the Blessed Virgin Mary. Still a lot older than she was. She was 15, probably. The thing about the doubt, he never doubted Mary's word. He always believed in the virginal birth. If you read the Gospel of Matthew closely, it's not that he thought she was unfaithful to him. He believed that she was still a maiden, but he realized if she is a maiden and she's with child, this is something supernatural and I need to step out of the picture. That was his crisis. It was not doubting her fidelity or her chastity. So I think if you really sort of uncover the real Joseph, a much different picture emerges. And that's what started to happen in the modern period. And then the popes picked up on this in the 19th century. They were big patrons of St. Joseph. And that's when he was off to the races.
It seems to me, and tell me if I'm right or wrong, that different patron saints, saints speak to ages differently. So Nicholas, patron saint of sailors, would have meant something at a time of dangerous sail ship. But now when most shipping are super tankers from China that are drone enabled, there's just not as many people with skin in the game. Whereas with fears and uncertainties about relationship status, his patronage to maidens could perhaps be something more emphasized. Have you seen this in places where different saints have different levels of popularity over the age as needs of ages come and go?
Oh, that's absolutely true. And you're right. Nicholas was a patron saint of sailors 500 years before he was ever a patron saint of gift givers. That association with Nicholas only comes in the later Middle Ages. But initially, he was a great patron saint of people who traveled the Mediterranean Sea. He was from the port town in Asia Minor. And people looked to him to protect them on the ocean. But one of the things that's interesting is the way saints get repurposed. So St. Isidore of Seville is the patron saint of the internet, even though he lived in the 600s or 700s. But he was an encyclopedist, and so he became the unofficial patron of the internet.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. He'd probably recognize and appreciate Wikipedia, or, you know, dislike some parts of it too.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, thanks for giving the overview for all these different saints. I think that helps understand how people approach these, how they're used historically, and how they're understood. At the end of your book, you have a toast. Could you please give a toast from your book to round these things out?
Absolutely. I think a good general purpose toast is to your health and holiness.
Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot, Michael. The book is Drinking with Your Patron Saints. So, really appreciate it, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. It was great being on.
Okay, well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, the McCrays, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
The history of the popes of Rome and Christianity reaches into nearly every aspect of history. In the History of the Papacy podcast, we step over the rope. We dive in to discover more about the people, events, and background that define the influence of the popes of Rome and church, not only on the West, but the world. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search for History of the Papacy on your favorite podcast platform.